But with the opening of the gates it becomes necessary to enable people to start from cold, as it were. In order to do this, we have devised an entirely new study course, which consists in the reading and discussion of my two little books, Esoteric Orders and Their Work and the Training and Work of an Initiate. These books give a general concept of the mystery, tradition and its workings, and the student who has read them, and thought about them, especially the latter, can, if he has the right kind of character, pick up his contacts with the mystery tradition on the inner planes. Or to be more precise, the tradition will pick him up. To discuss the ideas contained in these books under the direction of a teacher or group leader is the best way of getting into contact with the tradition, but where personal presence is impossible, we are arranging for students to correspond with members of our fraternity and so make a personal contact, even if an indirect one. We are not asking those who join our initial training course to pass examinations, but only to think about, and either write or talk about, the ideas in these two little books. This may seem very simple and unexacting, but it is not quite as haphazard as it looks, for unless there is the right approach, nothing will happen. But those who bring to the altar of the mysteries acceptable gifts of character and dedication will, sooner or later, and more often sooner than later, find that in a sudden flash of reality the masters have made contact. Such a flash is usually a brief moment of illumination. It is impossible to hold it for longer than that in any intensity. It may, in a less intense form, or as the aftermath of such a moment, continue for some days as a state of spiritual insight and exaltation, but it never by any chance continues long. If it did, it would disorganize the mind by its intensity, for the untrained human mind is not built to carry such voltages, hence the prolonged training that is necessary in order to attain to the higher grades of initiation. But some sudden sense of reality that can and should be as a result of study along the lines indicated. It may be as faint and elusive as the fragrance of flowers in the dark, but it will nevertheless be something outside the ordinary range of experience, and it will convey the sense that the invisible realities are real, that they have been known at first hand, and that one is no longer dependent upon second-hand testimony for knowledge of the secret wisdom and all that proceeds from it. Once this flash of reality has come, and gone, the student is in an entirely different position, for he has been contacted. Whatever doubts and difficulties may fall to his lot in the future, he will never lose his sense of reality of an invisible world which is the plane of causation to our world. He can, moreover, put the matter to the test experimentally. If at a time when his consciousness is heightened by spiritual tension in difficulty or danger he reconstructs in his imagination the scene of his exaltation and involves the master who then contacted him, that master will come through again and in some way make his presence known. Sometimes it is done by a renewal of that same inner sense of reality, sometimes by definite physical signs such as a sense of glowing heat, the movement of air in a still room, the scent of flowers or incense, a bell, like note, or even, to those who are naturally psychic, the actual presence manifesting. Those who follow the mystery tradition do not need to depend upon second-hand evidence. Ours is not a school which teaches a doctrine only. Unless we can give first-hand experience, we consider we have failed to initiate. Now as to the work that can be done by those who take the initial training and serve in the outer court. Each day for a quarter of an hour they are asked to sit quietly in meditation, thinking of the masters and their work for humanity. As the concept becomes clear to them and they get onto their contacts, they become like radio transmitters through which the influence of the masters comes through to humanity for the healing of the nations. April 1943, on the orders of Himmler, after strong resistance, SS troops finally kill or transport 60,000 Jews from the Warsaw Ghetto. In the seventh monthly letter, Dion Fortune turns to the type of work with which initiates of a modern esoteric fraternity should be concerned. There are two aspects to this. One is a teaching role, the other the practical use of what is learned in the teaching. This implies the use of powers of their mind and their possible abuse. Although as Dion Fortune points out, this is by no means a problem exclusive to esoteric fraternities. In these, the principal safeguard is the quality and direction of the initiate's dedication, and the oversight of the masters in a properly contacted group. Monthly letter number 7, for April 1943 and number 8, for May 1943. The work of the initiate in the world of today. I. Those who look back through the files of the weekly letters will note a distinct difference in subject matter between them and their successors, the monthly letters. The weekly letters dealt with day-to-day topics during the critical early phases of the war, when our morale needed all the help it could get and the incoming life wave had not yet been canalized into its appointed course. A new energy was surging into the soul of the nation as it roused itself to fight for its life, and those of us who looked out upon the scene from the watchtower on the Hill of Vision knew that unless this energy were directed to ends beyond the immediate war aims, it would sink into the sands of time once more for lack of a defined channel. Therefore, although our organization is definitely non-political, we felt that we could not do otherwise than indicate the significance of the things that were happening in the soul of the nation, because it is only the mystical psychologist who has any inkling as to what they are, and although there are many mystics and still more psychologists outside our ranks, we doubt if there are many, or even any, mystical psychologists, so it had to be us or nobody. We had several resignations from old members who were displeased because we expressed the opinion that things would, and should, change profoundly, but we had a great many more admissions of new members who felt that we could give them the particular kind of inner light they needed. In due course, we felt that we had covered the ground that needed covering, and we saw that, as we had been promised, those who could command the attention of the nation were giving direction and organization to the ideals which we could only formulate and intellectualize. We therefore felt that our work in this direction was done, and so we changed the weekly letters into a monthly communication which permitted of longer and more varied articles, and putting aside the day-to-day comments on a situation which no longer possessed the same urgency, we once again directed our attention to pure as distinguished from applied esoteric science. But as those who have studied the tree of life know, the swing of the pendulum is inherent in evolution, and once again we must turn our attention, though not exclusively, to mundane problems, not by descending into the political arena, but by making the particular contribution to the mental life of our race which it is in our power, and in that of none other, to make. This contribution takes two forms. Its primary form consists in explaining the esoteric knowledge concerning evolution and human nature and destiny, and in showing the practical application of those doctrines to the problems of human life, individual and collective. On the basis of the principles that clearly emerge from the esoteric teachings, it will be found possible to work out a broad scheme of reconstruction for society and of a way of life for individuals that shall be no patchwork of expediencies, no short-term policy of opportunism, but a plan that shall be based on, and coordinated with, the vast evolutionary movement which is the will of God. Only what is built on such lines can endure, all else must inevitably fall as the evolutionary tide rises, and, before its final disintegration, cause untold suffering because it is against nature. The better the organization and the more powerful the interests that support it, the greater the suffering and confusion if the original plan be wrongly conceived. But however powerful and efficient it may be, it cannot endure indefinitely because he shall turn and overturn till he whose right it is shall reign. But in addition to this, the primary educational aspect of our work, there is another aspect which cannot rightly be called secondary to the first, because without the contribution it has to make, the primary purpose may well be rendered inoperative. It is secondary in the time sense only, in that the primary work of understanding cosmic principles must come first, for without such knowledge taken to heart, the supplementary aspects are both incomprehensible and dangerous. This is not a contradiction in terms, for it is possible to understand enough of the teaching to make a rule of thumb application of it without any realization of the principles on which it rests and in the light of which only it can be properly applied. This secondary teaching is a part of the secret teaching of the mysteries, carefully guarded by those to whom it has been entrusted because of its immense power for evil as well as for good. In the right hands it is for the healing of the nations and the initiation of individuals. In the wrong hands it affords a ready means of reducing both nations and individuals to slavery. It has been widely used for this purpose of recent years, and is regarded as a practical application of psychology or mind power. There are innumerable correspondence courses, mostly American in origin, based on half-understood applications of the great principles of creative mind power. They owe their origin in the first place to the revelation of the power of the mind and its practical application given by Mrs. Eddy in Christian Science, and she, although it is denied in the orthodox accounts of her life, can be clearly proven to have derived her ideas in the first place from Quimby the hypnotist. She was, however, fully alive to the fact that the powers she developed had a dark side as well as a divine one, and took every precaution she could think of to prevent this dark side from being exploited. To this end she drew a sharp distinction between what she called the divine mind and mortal mind, or the mind of mortals. Critically examined, this distinction will not hold water, for man has but one mind with which to serve good or evil, but the distinction served a purpose in preventing the unsophisticated from experimenting along undesirable lines, and enabled them to get the maximum good out of the directed use of mind power and reduced its abuse to a minimum. Her device did not succeed, however, in deceiving the discerning, and out of a realization of what the mind could do when purposefully directed, arose a flock of schools and correspondence courses for the development of personality in the service of salesmanship, sex attraction and domination over others, all logical if not legitimate developments of Mrs. Eddy's teaching, and against which nothing could guard once the well-kept secret of the mysteries was out. It was for this reason that such knowledge has been kept secret by the initiates who are its repositories. Now it is out, however, it has got to be reckoned with, and the only way it can be dealt with is by understanding it thoroughly and developing the antidote. We now find ourselves in the same dilemma that confronted Mrs. Eddy. If we give out the knowledge necessary to combat the abuse of mind power, we supply the enemies of mankind with additional weapons, for mind power is a means to many ends and can be used indifferently for good or evil according to its motivation and direction. We therefore propose to pursue, for the present at any rate, a midway course, and to tell enough to enable the operations of mind power to be recognized, but not enough to enable the uninitiated to know how it is done. This affords a medium of negative protection in that it enables people to be on their guard and prevents them from being taken unawares and got under control by insidious means. We can go further than this, and supply certain formulae of protection which are of great value, but we dare not go the whole way and teach openly the real esoteric methods of mind, working lest these lead to worse evils than the ones they seek to combat. Nevertheless, it is urgently necessary to combat the organized forces abroad in the world, and for his purpose the deeper knowledge is necessary. But in giving this we shall abide by the tradition of the mysteries in restricting it to those who have proved themselves worthy to be entrusted with it and have undergone the discipline necessary to enable them to make practical application of the secret philosophy. The original development of the dark side of the secret wisdom is to be sought in the various mind power training courses so widely developed in the United States. Similar courses here are, as far as I know, for the most part importations of, or adaptions from, the original American sources. The English variety is more scrupulous in its methods and less extreme in its commercialism than the American, but though advertised as correspondence courses and charged for at a price which would be expected to include tuition, the amount of personal attention given to students is usually negligible and bears no relationship to the fees demanded. The courses might just as well have been published in book form at shillings instead of guineas, and with very few honorable exceptions, the whole correspondence course ramp written off as a catchpenny device. The application of psychology to salesmanship did not stop at the cultivation of the personality of the salesman, however, but went on to study of the use of mental suggestion by means of advertisement. This has been worked out with great skill in the drink trade, wherein a realistic picture of an overflowing glass and a slogan concerning its medicinal nature are widely used. The suggestion of a health value supplies an excuse, and the sight of the overflowing glass awakens desire. The path of an inebriate striving to overcome his craving is made infinitely harder by such pictorial publicity, and it ought to be prohibited for the same reason that pornography is prohibited. Other examples of such trading in human weakness are those which exploit snobbery in the cause of soap, less harmful no doubt, but equally illegitimate in principle. Out of advertising psychology came the next step, the use of mass suggestibility for political purpose. The methods of revivalist religion and political spell binders had long been identical, and so to say that it is not necessarily to condemn either or both, for it is only by such methods that the masses can be approached. Like other forms of mind power, they are not good or evil in themselves, but only in the use to which they are put. Billy Brown of London Town, with his lyrical advice on behavior in buses, so much more effective than the crude command "Do not spit," is an example of the right use of mass appeal. His humorous admonitions are accepted without the resentment that is aroused by commands and the association of delinquency with half-wittedness so admirably conveyed by the pictures Rob's Law, breaking of its charm, and the horror and disgust depicted on the faces of the onlookers at evil doings makes the best use of the snobbery that is innate in all save the nihilist, who may be trusted not to misbehave in buses anyway. Early in the history of broadcasting, its propaganda value was appreciated. In this country it was kept under government control and rigidly guarded against exploitation and abuse. In America its advertising value has been exploited, to the boredom of listeners, but on the whole it has not been basely used, unless the religious broadcasts of fantasies be considered an abuse, as well they may be when they instill fear or hatred. In Germany, however, it has been a different story. All that is known of mass suggestion has been placed at the service of totalitarian ideology and ruthlessly exploited, and along with such totalitarian use of propaganda goes the concomitant of the repression of all competing viewpoints that might serve as a starting point for rival propaganda. If you once start to influence or control minds, it is very difficult to know where you can end, or where the lines between legitimate guidance and undue influence can rightly be drawn. Very great wisdom and scrupulousness are needed for the right use of mental power. It is so insidious that it can be used unobserved, and therefore public opinion affords no safeguard. It is also liable to give rise to a sense of omnipotence and omniscience in those who use it that can only be kept in check by a deep sense of dedication, complete integrity and sincere humility, and this is to ask a great deal of any human being. There is only one efficient safeguard for the use of the powers conferred by a knowledge of the secret wisdom, and that is the discipline imposed on the initiate of the mysteries by the fact that he is answerable to the masters from whom no secret is hid, not even the secrets below the level of consciousness. The initiate who uses mind power does so under very strict safeguards. He can never develop any sense of omnipotence and omniscience because he knows that his work is only a part of a plan vast as the universe, and that he has to fit in with fellow workers serving God and man in a planned scheme. He himself is never the planner. There is but one planner, and that is the cosmic mind. The task of the initiate, dedicated to the service of God and man, is to wait upon the will of God in the silence until it becomes clear to him. He will then find that he has a certain definitely circumscribed part to play in a vast coordination of activities, and that before he can even play the small part assigned to him, he must prepare himself for it by rigorous self-discipline. His first task will be to make good as a human being in whatever sphere to which it has pleased God to call him, for no one is entrusted with cosmic tasks until he has proved himself upon mundane ones. It is never to the ineffective, unco-ordinated, or the ambitious that such responsibilities are entrusted. The power to influence other people is only entrusted to persons who have no desire whatever to use it, who have, in fact, a distaste for the task because they realize the terrible responsibilities involved. The greatest powers are always wielded in obscurity by initiates of the hermetic type who have nothing to gain by success and no means of reaping the fruits of their labors or taste for enjoying them. Promotion from grade to grade of the mysteries does not involve eminence, but greater obscurity and austerity. Those who travel on the path, travel light. It is also a law of the mysteries that no one can take a higher grade until he has trained his successor and handed over his task to him. Thus, far from guarding jealously the secret wisdom, initiates are always anxiously seeking for suitable successors in order that they may be free to take their grades, and the higher the grade, the harder are such to find. Under such conditions, and especially because each worker is entrusted with a strictly circumscribed task, the abuse of power by initiates is difficult and rare, and because the masters on the inner planes who direct the work can see the soul as clearly as we see the body, any aberration is quickly detected and dealt with by cutting the offender off from the cosmic scheme and turning him loose to deal as best he may with the forces he has set in motion. This is sufficient punishment for any man. January 1944, 50,000 Allied troops land at Anzio in Italy. In Russia, the Red Army breaks the 872-day siege of Leningrad. The monthly letters that follow contain a number of long serial articles, such as the principles of Hermetic philosophy. These will more appropriately appear in a separate volume, and this serialization in fraternity papers is a time-honored way in which Dionne Fortune wrote most of her books. However, shorter articles still found a place, as this one, in which she reiterates her belief in the importance of there being three strands in the discipline of the mysteries. She describes them as devotional, intellectual and artistic, which might be put in another way as the way of the mystic, the magician and the shaman. The ideal is the initiate who is at home in all three. She also sees the dawning of a new age in terms contemporary to her own viewpoint, with the Piscean Age going out with the First World War, the Aquarian Age coming in at the end of the Second World War, with the cusp between the two in the inter-war period. If not strictly in accordance with the astronomical indicators, it at least had the pragmatic quality of concentrating her mind on what she sought to achieve. And her concluding remarks demonstrate that she certainly knew all about the hands-on reality of running a magical fraternity. As she was so fond of saying, an ounce of practice is worth a pound of theory. Monthly letter number gifts 14, for January, 1944. In a fraternity making use of ceremonial and various forms of group working, it is necessary that a fraternal spirit in the fullest and highest sense of the word should prevail. The group mind becomes closely knit, and any rift between individual members affects the integration of the whole and disturbs, or if sufficiently severe, prevents magical working. The brethren will recall occasions when it has been necessary to cancel lodges for no other reason than a disturbed mental atmosphere within the group. Such close fellowship can only be maintained if there is the kind of tolerance among us that comes from an imaginative insight which enables people to understand and appreciate a mode of approach or method of working which they themselves do not share or are temperamentally incapable of achieving. This is very far removed from what is ordinarily understood by tolerance, which always seems to imply something of contempt only kept within bounds by lack of power to give it expression in persecution. We tolerate what we cannot stop. The tolerance that should prevail in the mysteries is better characterized by such terms as broad-mindedness and generosity, the willingness to admit that it is possible that we ourselves might be mistaken, or that what we have received from authoritative sources that seem to us unquestionable might be outmoded by the passage of time and require modification, and that there is more than one kind of excellence in the world. In other words, there is diversity of gifts, but the same spirit. Our fraternity makes provision for three main types of temperament: the devotional, the intellectual, and the artistic. Consequently, there is wide divergence of type among its members, and this diversity we encourage, considering it wholesome as leading to balance and broad-mindedness. There are profound truths in the terse and witty lines we would do so well to remember. If all the good people were clever, and all clever people were good, world would be better than ever we thought it possibly could. But alas, it is seldom or never that matters turn out as they should. The good are so hard on the clever, and the clever so rude to the good. But amid all the diversity we can distinguish a definite classification, and an appreciation of this may make it easier for the brethren to understand each other. This classification, as no student of the Kabbalah needs to be told, follows the lines of the Tree of Life. There are the three main types as previously indicated, just as there are the three pillars upon the tree, and there are different planes upon each pillar. The pillars traverse the tree vertically, and the planes horizontally. But although we can distinguish three basic temperaments following three distinct paths in theory, in actual practice we find few pure types, for people invariably contain all three aspects in their natures in differing proportions, and it is the percentage of proportion that determines their primary ray. Nevertheless, there are few among us who are content to work on one ray only, few who are content to be purely devotional with no tincture of the Hermetic wisdom, for instance. Equally, however, there are few who can combine all three modes of ray working. A primary and secondary ray working is practically universal among our members, so even though the balanced triangle is rare, there should always be some aspect of all that can be touched by each, and none should be entirely out of range of sympathy of any. If this occurs, something goes wrong with the group aura, and the rift soon declares itself and requires to be dealt with. We deal with it by excision. However excellent they may be as individuals, one or both have to go for the good of the fraternity if they cannot keep the peace. In magical working, the keeping of the peace consists of more than the absence of any overt breach of civility. It consists in that inner harmony and goodwill which is the microcosmic equivalent of the music of the spheres. The problem of type harmonization in our fraternity is further complicated by the time factor. Our work began at the close of the Piscean Age and was carried out by advanced Pisceans, pioneering the new ideas that were beginning to unfold in the racial consciousness. Time went by, evolution moved on, the purely Piscean Age passed away with the First World War, and we entered upon the cusp, or transition stage between ages. The main work of the fraternity was then carried on by people of the cusp, and the two types, the pure Piscean and the cusp Piscean, had to fit in together as best they might. There were difficulties, some of which were only solved by resignations. Then, with the Second World War, we began to pass out of the cusp phase, and pure Aquarian types made their appearance among us. All through the cusp phase I, as warden, held the fraternity together ruthlessly, modifying nothing and placating no one, and letting who would resign, taking their subscriptions with them. I have always been particularly careful to allow no one to obtain such a position of influence in the fraternity, for any reason, financial or other, that they could bring about a preponderance of the ray they favored. This has sometimes pressed hardly on individuals, who, having given long and loyal services and made great sacrifices, felt they were entitled to consideration. This they never got, and never will get. The masters never accept gifts with strings tied to them. What is given, and once accepted, passes out of the donor's control, to be used in the service of the policy of the fraternity as directed by the masters. All voting is by a show of hands, or if controversial, by ballot, not by the equivalent of a share, holding in the fraternity's spiritual stock. All souls are sacred, but none are privileged. By neither gifts nor services can anyone buy anything save opportunity in the fraternity. What use they make of the opportunity this afforded them depends on nothing but their own capacity. The masters accept what is given in a spirit of dedication, which means that the giving must be selfless and without ulterior motive. Many have given their all, myself among them, but I think I can justly say that no one has taken such risks as I have run in the service of the masters. Every new development of magical work involves risk until it is well established and in working order. I select certain persons to help me with the pioneering, and they undergo definite risk should anything go wrong with the working, but as leader I am the first to venture out into the unknown, and if the psychic ice will not bear, I am the one to go through. If anything goes wrong, I have to see everybody safely back before I can make my own escape. If the power gets out of hand, I have to earth it if I can, and if I failed, I should play the part of the blown fuse in an electrical installation. We do not always succeed at the first attempt in establishing a new grade on array, and each failure involves a critically dangerous moment as we who are concerned get out from under the falling structure.